Two catastrophic hurricanes within a week of one another, an earthquake in Mexico, wildfires in the western U.S., and 100-degree temperatures in California, is it time to start thinking about climate change? With an apparent anti-science movement abroad in the nation and climate change denial making its way all the way to the EPA and the Oval Office, we saw an opportunity to sort fact from fiction and to find out what our listeners are thinking. We're hoping to hear from you with questions or comments on the subject of global warming at the number 941-3689 or from neighbor islands at 877-941-3689. Our guests are Dr. Steve Reusinger, chair of the UH Atmospheric Sciences Department, and Camilo Mora, associate professor at the UH Geography Department in the College of Social Sciences. Again, that number is 941-3689, or if you're on a neighbor island, 877-941-3689. Thanks to both of you for coming in. And let's maybe start by trying to understand, first of all, the evidence for climate change, and then the movement of climate change denial, and try to understand how that has come about. But let's talk about the evidence for climate change, which has been accumulated for how long now?
Well, thank you for having us.
Sure.
This is Steve Reusinger. The evidence for climate change is actually very broad. It comes in a large variety of categories, like sea level rise, melting of ice sheets in the Arctic, glacier reduction, and then there's just increasing heat waves, increasing floods, and we can also bring a line that shows how extreme weather events have been impacted by climate change as well.
We've seen some extreme weather events in the last couple of weeks. Is it valid to make a comparison, make a connection?
A lot of scientists probably will tell you that they cannot say yes or not to that answer, to that question. I personally will say with 100%, 95% certainty that climate change will be shown to have some impact on these things that just happened recently. Mm-hmm. My argument for this is the fact that, as Steve pointed out, you have many elements of the climate, all of which are connected, right? Precipitation, heat, floods, all of these things are connected, and we had a driving force that is heat. We know that we are making the planet hotter by us producing CO2. So when you increase CO2, obviously you are going to cause all of these changes, all of which are going to be triggered by that heat. Obviously, these things have happened before, and you will probably hear a lot of climate deniers saying these things have happened before. How is it any different now? Well, the reason is that you are putting more heat into this equation. So this is like a baseball player making two home runs. You gave steroids to this baseball player. Now he makes four.
Yeah.
So how many home runs you can say are the results of the steroids? Two or four? Personally, yeah. I would say the four of them. Right now, even the two that he could do naturally are being impacted by the use of steroids. And that, in the sense of climate change, this is like turning a hurricane 2 into a hurricane 4. Just the addition of this extra heat that you are putting there. So that is why I feel confident that even if climate change is not the whole responsible for this, it's what making these events much worse.
We've heard that comparison as hurricanes on steroids, right?
Yes, and it turns out that hurricanes are a heat engine. We understand the thermodynamics really well.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out if you increase the sea surface temperature by 1 degree centigrade, it will increase the winds in a hurricane by 8 meters per second, which is about 20 miles per hour.
That's very serious.
So that's a very clear relationship. And the other thing is that if you have a warmer sea surface temperature, you get more humidity in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And 1 degree warmer sea surface temperature at these warm temperatures that hurricanes thrive under means that you will have an increase of 7% in the vapor pressure in the lower atmosphere, and that's the fuel for the storm.
Now, I would like to add to that, though, so that people don't have to think about that you have to do a PhD to understand this. This hurricane Irma that just happened, it was a hurricane category 3 by the end of Cuba.
Right.
It went through the space between Cuba and Florida, and the ocean was warm there. And because of that additional warming of that ocean, that hurricane was classified again to a category 4. So you can see from there how the heat that was on that tiny piece of ocean made that hurricane going from a category 3 back to a category 4, just for people to appreciate how the ocean and the heat of the ocean makes these events much worse.
That's unusual, isn't it? Because my understanding in past hurricanes is that frequently when they pass over an area of open ocean, they get downgraded rather than upgraded. Is that not not accurate?
Well, it's true that when hurricanes like a very nice symmetric environment, and right. if they pass over an island like Cuba, the wind flow gets disrupted, and that causes the storm to weaken. Mm-hmm. Hurricanes will weaken after landfall, so they like open ocean in that regard. But what's interesting in the case of a storm like Harvey, we had about half a degree warmer than average sea surface temperatures. And the fact that it came in as a Category 4 storm is I think, very noteworthy, because if the ocean temperature had been a degree or a degree and a half cooler, as it might have been back in the middle of the last century, mm-hmm. this storm would have come in at a Category 2 or a Category 3. So there is a difference in terms of, as sea surface temperatures rise, the potential for storms to be more intense is definitely real.
That's what Camilo just compared to steroids.
That's right.
Now, there's another factor with Harvey, and that's that it moved incredibly slowly. It just kind of stalled over Texas. Mm-hmm. And one of the predictions of climate change is that you will have a decrease in the westerlies and a northward movement during the summertime of the jet stream farther into Canada. And that leaves more high pressure and lighter winds over places like the Gulf of Mexico, mm-hmm. and the Caribbean, and even Hawaii. And recent research has shown that the maximum intensity of hurricanes is shifting gradually northward in time, and that's a trend that's expected to continue. And in particular for Hawaii, that's not good news, because most of the hurricanes that we see pass just to the south of the Hawaiian Islands, historically.
Right.
And if that track moves a bit northward, then the Big Island's going to see a lot more hurricanes approaching from the west. And we've sort of seen that already. In 2015, we had three Category 4 storms churning around the Hawaiian Islands. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have a direct hit, thank God, but because we are kind of a small target. But the writing's on the wall that we'll probably see as much as two additional hurricanes per hurricane season by the middle of the century.
One thing that I want to point out to that is the fact that all of this requires public attention. And I think that a lot of the lack of public attention has to do with the scientists and the media, in the sense that we always emphasize these things when they happen, just like we are doing right now, but people will forget these things by next week.
Yeah.
Just like we were talking about heat waves this summer, we don't talk about heat waves anymore. So we need to start remembering things. We suffer from a short-term memory loss, in the sense that these things are forgotten very quickly. And I like, Chris, what you did early on when you point out how we went from a heat wave in the summer to a wildfire in the middle to now a flood to now a hurricane. People need to start remembering these things to realize that this is as real as it can get, and that the planet is the health of the planet is at stake on these things.
Well, we have this thing called the 24-hour news cycle, which kind of enforces short-term memory loss, because we quickly replace one memory with another. Let me just interject something real quickly. We want to hear from listeners, so let me give a phone number again. 941-3689. Are on a neighbor island, 877-941-3689, because this is something we haven't done before on this program, but we do like to hear from listeners. And here's a question from Walter Wright of Kaneohe. Well, Walter, let's bring you in on the line, and I'll let you ask your question yourself.
Hey, I'm here.
Hey. What's your question, Walter?
The question is whether or not the ocean warming in the Pacific is going to increase the intensity as well as the number of the hurricanes that might hit Hawaii. But
no, that's an excellent question. And certainly there's been a lot of research in recent times regarding the number of hurricanes that will be spawned in the future. And there is a debate on that question in general. However, for Hawaii in particular, we are in an unfortunate situation that the track of the hurricanes seems to be shifting northward. And so the climate models are indicating that we will see additional hurricanes in the future, specifically in Hawaii. That's not necessarily true for everywhere on the planet. And so far, it doesn't seem as though the number of hurricanes, the total number of hurricanes has increased. However, the most number of most intense hurricanes has increased. So that's the climate change factor.
Again, this is another thing where the scientists, we should keep away from talking to the public about this uncertainty, though, because this saying to us, that saying to the people that we just don't know or hasn't been shown, what it does to the general public is to believe that there is nothing there. Now, unfortunately, the debate that has happened at the scientific level is the fact that we had a huge variability on the frequency of these hurricanes. They happen all the time. So it's very hard for us as a scientist to claim that they had happened. Fortunately, is the way in which the question has been formulated. And the change that has happened is now to say that these hurricanes are happening one in a thousand, one in a hundred, 100 to 1,000 years events now are becoming things that happen every 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, the flood that just happened in Florida, Texas.
So-called 100-year storms are now 10-year storms.
Exactly. So it changed the conversation from saying whether this is caused by climate change or not, is to say, well, yes, it's just like the asteroids. You know, the example of the asteroids is a good example there, because the Hornrum is always going to happen.
The asteroids. Yeah.
But then you had this additional thing that pushes things over the limit to make them either more extreme, mm-hmm. or something that happens every 1,000 years to something that happens now 100 years to something that happens every 10 years.
Just to sort of put a little historical context into this, when did the phenomenon of climate change become measurable? When did this start affecting the planet? 20 years ago? 30 years ago? 100 years ago?
I would say that it became statistically significant above the variability in looking at the data probably about 30 years ago.
Yeah.
At that point, scientists were quite clear on the fact that there was evidence that global warming was starting to happen. I'd like to make a plea, though, that one of the things that because the news cycle is so short, but I wanted to give people a short list of things they can do at home in order to reduce their carbon footprint.
Mm-hmm.
And I can read this very quickly.
Okay.
And you can say, well, you know, these things are way beyond what I can do, so I'm just going to forget about it. But I think it's worth considering. Become a vegetarian, eat organic, buy local. Live in the climate. Live in the climate means don't always expect to have 70 degrees in your house and your car and your workplace.
Don't crank your air conditioning.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Dry line your clothes. Vote with your feet. Reduce and reuse before you recycle. And you can also offset your carbon emissions. If you have to fly for your work, you can do things through the United Nations to provide some funding so that the carbon footprint is decreased elsewhere, such as buying solar power in India.
Well, actually, you can do that here. By the way, here in the state of Hawaii, we have over 80% of the land completely damaged already. And we have different projects on site right now that will allow the individual people to go and, for instance, plant trees so that those trees will sequester that CO2 and as a way to offset the emissions that you had.
Yeah, that's excellent.
We have got a caller on the line. Billy from Haiku, Maui, has a question. I'm going to open up the line to hear his question.
Yes.
Hi, Billy. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder why people are focused on the environment, but I think they ought to know how to protect themselves from the environment by building, like, earth houses and dome houses and not building on the beaches, which is eroding, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're all connected. That's what I was thinking about. Okay. Aloha.
Yeah, thanks, Billy.
I'd love to address that one. One of the things that's very clear to me is with this situation in Texas. Texas has this idea of protecting the low-lying areas with levees that fail. They're designed supposedly for the 100-year flood, but they end up failing every other year.
Mm-hmm.
So they clearly are not doing a good job. They have very poor zoning, too, allowing people to build in flood zones. If they were to really protect Houston and places like New Orleans for the 10,000-year storm, it would cost about the same as it does for the recovery of a couple of these storms. So an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Well said. Another caller from Kahulu has a question. Charlie, you on the line?
Yep.
Yeah, what's your question?
Well, basically, it's like you're driving down the road, your whole family's in the car, and you're going at 100 miles an hour, and you don't know what the road is like ahead of you. So you just think, well, what's the odds that there's a lot of curves? Should I just keep going at 100 miles an hour and take the chance, or should I reduce my speed? And it's not like there's nothing we can do, so why take the chance? You know, the chances, the consequences are so dire. I don't know why, you know, a denier would even take the chance. That's what I don't understand about that mentality is, have people actually done psychological, you know, questioning of these people?
Well, Charlie, these people are a fairly sizable percentage of our population. But Camilo, what's your response to that?
That is actually something that worries me the most about climate change is the fact that we think that we're going to fix these things when we get there. Unfortunately, when we get there, it's going to be way too late.
Right.
Exactly because of what you are saying there. The actual scientific term for that is called inertia.
Yeah.
So, and the example that we normally use is like the Titanic is about to hit an iceberg. They saw it coming. They saw it. They had 15 minutes. They put their trolls back. They were moving sideways. But the speed at which they were going was so fast that they couldn't avoid that iceberg. Mm-hmm. Again, because the speed was too high. It's the same thing with climate change. We are heating up the planet at such a fast speed that once these things start cranking in, like heat waves, storms, floods, all of this stuff, it's just going to be way too late for us to dial back on this thing. Exactly. That's one of the reasons why I get so worried about it, exactly because of the thing that you point out there. We call it inertia of these changes.
You know, the sense that I get from your question is there's a lot of news out there that says that there's uncertainty. And the uncertainty is kind of like a fog, and you're in a car and you're driving through the fog, and the fog gets thicker and thicker, and you know that there's a cliff ahead, or you know that there's a bridge out.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't we slow down a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
And in this metaphor, the slowing down is doing things that are going to reduce our carbon footprint, and of course the government ought to be first and central in this. In moving us away from fossil fuels and into renewables, but we can do a lot ourselves as well.
Well, but one thing about that you point out the government there, which is totally true, but I think that more importantly is the general people, because most countries around the world, you still had a democratic system in which is the people that chooses the governments. So, for instance, having a president like the one that we have right now that is destroying any policy protecting the environment and the climate speaks pretty loud, not about the president as much as he speaks about the people that elected that president. So I think that that's where we need to start realizing the limitations that we had to deal with if we want to make a big difference, is that we need everybody to start understanding and take these things more seriously, because that will determine who is going to be on government at the end of the day.
Again and again, we come back to education. And when you talked about inertia, I remember learning about that in eighth grade science, you know, an object in motion tends to remain in motion, et cetera. I wonder if kids today are learning about that at that age, because, you know, understanding science and the scientific method should, I would think, come pretty early in your education, because it isn't just what you're learning in science class. It's a way of thinking and a way of verifying information, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would certainly second that. That education is very, very important in this endeavor. We all live on a very small island in space. The atmosphere is extremely thin, and you can go through half the atmosphere just basically by going to the top of Mauna Kea. That atmosphere is not able to take all of the pollution that we put in it without it having a pretty big effect. And so that's something that we just have to be responsible about.
Let me just interject something. A caller who didn't want to be broadcast live from Hilo recommends a documentary called Earth, the Operator's Manual. So that's something to keep in mind. A caller from Kona Richard asks, why hurricanes go north before going? Oh, Richard, I'll let you ask the question.
Yeah, I lived here for a long time, 77, in a sailboat sailed over here. And we got acquainted with the island weather. And when over since then, we've watched storm after storm that used to go south of the Big Island, come from the east and basically go around the Big Island and then turn up towards Kauai or Oahu. And now, instead of doing that, it gets about two-thirds of the way over, and it starts veering up in about a 45-degree angle, kind of most of them. And so that's the first question, why is that? Second question is, why does the I kind of imagined the Big Island as a barn, and if it was hard weather, you'd go to the other side of the barn where the
We're rapidly running out of time. We need to boil it down to a single question because we've only got about a minute left, Richard. But
I think I can address these. Basically, the spin of the planet imparts the spin to hurricanes as well. It's mm-hmm. called the Coriolis force. And the Coriolis force does tend to make hurricanes move gradually in a northward direction away from the equator. You'll notice that hurricanes never cross the equator. So that's part one. Why hurricanes are tending to move in an easterly direction south of the Big Island and then turn, that could very well be because we have this Hawaiian high to the north of us in the summertime that pushes the hurricanes and keeps them south. They're on a easterly or the westerly track toward the west, and then as they pass the Big Island, there's a bit of slacking in the winds, and they turn more northward and hit Kauai.
Well, I wish we had more time, but I want to thank both of you for at least moving us toward a little further to an understanding of this complex subject, and thanks to our callers for calling in. Dr. Steve Buesinger is chair of the UH Atmospheric Sciences Department. Camilo Mora is an associate professor at the UH Geography Department in the College of Social Sciences. Thanks to both of you for being with us.